You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Because he's a very good person. I've always found him to be just a very, very good person. And by the way, a very, very talented person. And a lot of people think he's going to run my campaign.
Yeah.
My campaign's doing pretty well.
Donald Trump enthusing about former Fox News chief Roger Ailes, who may or may not now be preparing him to debate Hillary Clinton. We'll be looking at Trump's recent round of hirings and firings. Is he writing his listing craft or merely rearranging the deck chairs? My guests Daniela Pellet and James Boyes will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Turkey's decision to make room for thought criminals by releasing actual criminals and a high-profile defection from one London embassy. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellet, Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and James Boyes, historian and author, most recently of Hillary Rising. Welcome both to the programme. And we will start tonight with Donald Trump's campaign for the US presidency, which it is beginning to feel safe to laugh at again. Faced by encouragingly apocalyptic polling numbers, the Orange former game show host has reshuffled his campaign team for the second time in as many months. His new campaign manager is pollster Kellyanne Conway, whose previous experience includes making Dan Quayle the political colossus he is today, and his new overall campaign chief is Stephen Bannon, executive chairman of Breitbart, a splenetically conservative website which makes Fox News look like the New York Review of Books. James, first of all,
yes, sir.
Is this the desperate double or nothing throw that it appears to be?
Yeah, I mean, I put on Twitter today, I mean, I'm calling it for Hillary. I mean, it's just point blank. To me, it's a no-brainer anymore. I mean, a lot of people will say, well, it's far too early to say that. But quite frankly, if you look at the structure that Donald Trump simply is not putting into place across the country, state by state, this time last time round, 4 years ago, for example, Mitt Romney had got 22 field offices in Florida. Donald Trump now has one. He simply is not playing the game you need to play to win the presidency. It's a two-stage game. You win the primaries, great, he's done that. But he has shown no inclination whatsoever to know how to manoeuvre to win the presidency in the general election. And by bringing in people like the chap from Breitbart, for example, there's speculation that Roger Ailes is coming in. This is someone who's under a massive cloud. He's been pushed out of Fox News for basically sexual harassment.
We will be coming to that
shortly. Fair enough. You know, these are not the people you bring on board if you want to win the presidency. It's not enough to run to the far right of the Republican Party to win the presidency. You get the nomination that way. You have to then come back to the centre to get the centre ground of American politics, and he has shown no propensity to do that whatsoever.
All of which is true. Daniela, I just wonder if at this point, has Trump or someone near him realised that not only is he not going to win as things are, he is not either willing or capable to actually reach out to the centre ground in the manner that James suggests. So is actually your best option at this point really just to go full swivel-eyed honking fruitcake and hope somehow that works out?
Well, that has always kind of been his USP, really. And I think we had a small wobble where there was some advice to reach out to the middle ground and try and be a little bit more circumspect with some of his more extreme views. But then that's not Trump. And Trump, let Trump be Trump, I think, has been his major strategy. And I mean, I sincerely hope that James is right. But similarly, you could say that that Trump, for the sake of the future of the human race, really.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
But I can say that Trump's modus operandi up to now has been to tear up the rule book and to do things in a completely, in a new way. You know, okay, he has very little money. He hasn't reached any of the markers that previous candidates have done. But I don't think that's quite enough to reassure me that we've reached the stage where we can say, okay, we can stop worrying about Trump becoming president. We can start worrying about the reasons why he actually managed to get, what is it, 38, 39% support?
This is a thing that is, it's... we shouldn't put out of our minds entirely. Even if he does get beaten, and beaten as badly as he looks like he's going to get beaten, there is no getting around the fact that literally tens of millions of citizens of the United States will have gone into a booth and pulled a lever or pressed a button saying they want Donald Trump, of all people, to lead the free world.
If you're talking about when they vote in the general election, you're absolutely right, because they'll be voting along party lines. But the Republican Party itself is absolutely apoplectic by the state of what's going on. Just to throw some figures around. Hillary Clinton is now 10 points ahead in many of the leading states at this point and has cleared the 50% barrier, which is a massive psychological barrier. Donald Trump, therefore, is in the high 30s. There's 85 days left to election day. There simply is not enough time for him to claw back anything that's going to put him in charge. He needs to be winning, don't forget, not just key Republican states where he is now actually doing very, very poorly in polling. He needs to do more than Mitt Romney and John McCain ever did. And he shows no ability to do that. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that he's coming even close to that. So at this point, you know, it's to me, you know, if you take Donald Trump's bluster out of this, and the whole, you know, look at me, trust me, I'm a snake oil salesman kind of pitch out of this. If you look at it on a mathematical basis, this is over.
Looking at his new hirings, though, Daniela, and this is an abyss I spent some of the afternoon staring into without any particularly satisfactory outcome. Why would anybody, do you think, want to go and work for Donald Trump at this point? He is very much the kind of leader you would only follow out of curiosity.
Well, you could ask, why would anybody want to come and work for him in the first place? And why would anybody want to come and work for him, you know, at many points in this campaign? Never mind his, ideologically, why would anybody work for a candidate that seems, right now, to be the loser? It baffles me. But then there are people of a certain calibre working for him that you'd be quite surprised.
You were looking suddenly animated over there, James.
Because are you available? I desperately want to help Trump here. The whole point is, the reason he's hired these two people is that because anybody with any credibility won't work for him. This is the whole point, is he's pulled these people in. If you go from the top of his career, from his campaign team, right down to the local state level, nobody of any credibility wants to work for him. He's got people running this show who've got no experience whatsoever playing at this level. The hires he's made today, as you beautifully articulated in your introduction, have no experience playing at the senior level that Donald Trump is now forcing them to do. And this comes back to my whole point. If you want to win the presidency, you've got to put a team around you who know what they're doing. And he just won't do it.
Well, the idea that
they won't work for
the idea that the founder of Fox News might be planning to...
He is suddenly available.
Well, he is. It's true, he's suddenly available.
He's never run a presidential campaign, is my point.
He's had a job before, which is frankly impressive as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we will, on that note, move along slightly, but sticking with the Trump campaign, because it, like the rest of us, is bracing itself for the glorious prospect of their candidate having to debate on live television with someone more or less sane, a task for which the Republican primaries will have ill-prepared him. Reports yesterday did suggest that Trump had summoned the counsel of former Fox News chief Roger Ailes, who recently resigned in the face of sexual harassment allegations. These reports have since been denied by Trump's people, who have nevertheless helpfully confirmed that the pair are longtime friends. So I'm glad they've cleared that up. Daniela, I'm going to cast you as Donald Trump's campaign manager here at this point. And frankly, the way things are going, with 85 days still to go, it could happen. Your number might come up. Is Trump's best hope basically to somehow try and bluster his way out of having any debates at all?
I would say yes, definitely, definitely, definitely. But I mean, I disagree a little bit with James here, because Roger Ailes has got some record in this kind of media management in previous candidates. He's not not a terrible record either. Look, I think when Trump is next to Clinton and they have this debate, it is going to go. I'm trying to think of a more polite way to use a very British phrase that perhaps won't go down too well on Monocle. But yeah, it's not going to look good for him. I think these things have a lot of meaning, actually, the debate. When you see people psychologically, beyond even differences in policy, when you see people next to each other. I remember in 2008 when Obama was debating John McCain. I remember one particular moment where John McCain turned to Obama and we said something very dismissive and a very dismissive hand gesture. He said, that one, he said, scorning some policy. I can't remember what the policy was, but I thought that, wow, that's really bad news from you, John.
It can often be the case, can it, with debates? It's one moment, it's one gesture, it's Al Gore sighing, for example.
Right, exactly. It's, you know, Neil Kinnock going, yay, if anybody remembers that.
I do. You're absolutely right. You're right. But, sorry.
No, I think that's it. It could really turn on, you know, something that simple. And, well, not even simple, because it's very hard for Donald Trump to open his mouth without saying something really, really wrong in almost every sense one can imagine.
I am normally a big fan of the 22nd Amendment, which, of course, limits presidents to two terms. But I would pay a great deal of money to watch Barack Obama versus Donald Trump in a presidential debate. It would not be a fair fight. But from that point of view, again, James, I'll make you Donald Trump's campaign chairman for the next few seconds. Okay. How do you handle this? Because would in a presidential debate against somebody who, whatever, however tempted she might be, she will keep calm, she will stay on point, she's rational, she's organised, she's thoughtful. Will Donald Trump's usual shtick play in that environment?
I think that what he will desperately try to do is to get the agreed upon three debates down to one, first of all, and then he will come out all guns blazing. You're absolutely right. Hillary Clinton, if she, one of her flaws, arguably, is that she's a one-gear candidate. I mean, she's brilliant, but she knows she plays politics pretty much straight down the middle. Donald Trump is kind of like the Looney Tune candidate at this point. He's going to come out of this and he's going to throw the kitchen sink at her live in front
of millions and millions.
He'll raise questions about her health. He'll raise questions about Bill Clinton, his potential infidelities as first husband. He'll raise Benghazi. He'll accuse Hillary of becoming, you know, the founder of ISIL. You name it. Absolutely everything. Because at that point, quite frankly, we'll be so close to the election, people are going to start voting, don't forget, in absentee ballots, in postal votes, much sooner than the election day. So he has nothing to lose at that point by trying to humiliate her. But all I can say is, I think the reverse will happen. He'll end up humiliating himself. These debates, as you rightly point out, they usually turn on a dime with somebody saying something stupid. Of the two candidates, who do you think is more likely to do that?
I mean, we should look at it from the other point of view as well. And I'll ask you first, Daniela, because it is, it's a tricky one for Hillary Clinton's team as well, because he is such an unconventional candidate. And normally, if you're preparing to debate against somebody who operates within the agreed parameters of politics, you know how that works. You try to find lines of weakness in their sort of personal history or on policy. You try and think of lines that'll work. You can anticipate their responses to a certain extent. It's almost impossible to sort of imagine what Donald Trump is going to say or do in response to anything. How does Hillary Clinton prepare for this?
Well, I think it would be very easy for her to remain calm, remain cool, and just deflect his accusations and make a fair few of her own. But at the same time, that cool calmness is kind of her weak point as well, because she's so on the level and displays so little emotion and seems so cold and sort of one-dimensional that seeing her in a debate, I think she's very good at sort of, you know, giving an oration and, you know, laying out policy, but actually skewering Trump. I would like to see her actually go much more on, be a bit passionate and go a little bit more on the offensive rather than just letting him, giving enough rope to hang himself, which is kind of, it's the logical thing to do, really.
I mean, is there a point of attempting to, I mean, how would you play it, James? Because the thing that would strike me as the obvious thing to do, but I can also see why it wouldn't work, is, and there's no shortage of material, you pick out particular things Trump has definitely unequivocally said, mm-hmm. which are demonstrably, manifestly not true.
Sure.
And just say, well, can you explain this? But he won't, because he will just say words in that way that he does. And it is an extraordinary thing with Trump. If you actually read written down things he has said in conversation, it's I mean, it is as next to gibberish as makes no odds.
He is the through-the-looking-glass candidate, quite frankly. He makes things up on the hoof presents them as facts, suggesting that he voted against or spoke out against the Iraq War, for example, which he patently didn't. If you're Hillary Clinton, you can come out with lots of things to throw at him, as you both rightly talk about. For example, the fact that he endorsed Hillary Clinton in the past. And there's recordings of this.
He invited her to one of his weddings, in fact.
There we are. But he actually said she'd make a great president. president. You know, this is something that's actually, it's on record, it's recorded on one of his many podcasts. You know, the Clinton campaign at the moment are sitting back and letting him talk himself into oblivion. To answer your question directly, there is precedent. In 2000, when she ran for the Senate, she was debating against a little-known congressman called Rick Lazio. He took a very, took a very aggressive stance. And Hillary basically stepped back and won the sympathy vote because she was seen to being attacked by this boisterous, bombastic individual. And I think we can see a potential line there that she might well take come the debates this year.
Okay, well, you mentioned podcasts there. Hillary Clinton now has one. She has launched a presidential campaign podcast. It's called With Her. It sounds a bit like this.
Before we get started, I have a question for you.
Yes.
What should I call you?
You can call me whatever you want to call me. You can call me Hillary. You can call me Madam Secretary. You can call me Hey You, anything you want.
I'm not going to call you Hey You, but I'll call you Hillary.
Okay.
We ready? Hi, Hillary.
Hi, Max.
Hi, I'm Max Linsky. I run this new small podcasting company, and I've always wanted to know what it's really like to run for president. Turns out Hillary Clinton's campaign wanted to tell that story, too. So now I'm in a small conference room in Miami talking to the nominee for the first episode of With Her, Hillary Clinton's official campaign podcast.
I'm leaning Trump, having heard that. Daniela, would you take time out of your busy day to listen to a podcast by a presidential candidate?
Well, guess what? I took time out of my busy day today to listen to it. It's about 15 minutes long. I think I made it to perhaps the 6-minute mark, and I was asleep for most of that. God, it's awful. I mean, I don't know who it's aimed at. Is it supposed to be to the people who really, really heart Hillary and they want to know what she's up to and what she had for breakfast and what time she wakes up? I discovered that she wakes up at 6:30 and yes, she has an alarm clock. I mean,
amazing.
What is this intended? I mean, it's a great coup for the podcasters, you know, to have her on. I don't know if they're going to have her on every week. I think you could make a very interesting podcast about what it's like being at the heart of a presidential campaign.
You certainly could.
This wasn't it, though.
I mean, James, final thought on this from you. Sure. Who on earth is going to listen to this? This is not something that people who are, you know, toying with voting Trump, wavering a bit maybe, are actually going to download and spend, you know, 16 minutes listening to.
I don't know who has time to listen to these things anyway, quite frankly, let alone one on Hillary Clinton.
But apart from Midori House,
which is a live broadcast, the many podcast. Avid, we're not distributing.
We are also a podcast available from our website or on iTunes. And avidly listened to by millions.
One of the things, since we're plugging, one of the things I raised in Hillary Rising was the idea was the idea that when Hillary Clinton attempts to appeal to a young, dare I say, hip dynamic demographic, she singularly fails to do so. When she launched her presidential campaign in 2008, her and her husband restaged, I don't know how many people can remember this, the last scene from The Sopranos to unveil her campaign song, which was a terribly flawed concept because if you think about it, Hillary and Bill are playing Tony and Camilla Soprano, who both, it is implied, get shot at the end of that scene, both of whom are basically gangsters, and they're casting themselves in this scenario. And they end up choosing a song by the gal who did the song from Titanic.
Celine Dion.
The most forgettable song of all time, potentially. So they have a really poor track record when it comes to embracing social media, I think.
Well, we are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellad and James Boyes. Coming up next, Turkey releases thousands of prisoners to make room for thousands of prisoners.
For all of Paris's vibrancy, its story is best evoked in the places where time just marched on past. To find them, you'll have to take the rue less traveled, just like the artists and thinkers who made the city famous. This is where the Monocle Travel Guide to Paris steps in. We've cut through all the touristy noise to uncover the lesser-known gems that we feel embody the essence of the French capital. To watch our film celebrating the 10th edition of the Monocle Travel Guide series, head to monocle.com et voilà.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Daniela Peled and James Boyes. Now, it is one thing for any disgruntled potentate to snap his fingers and order a rounding up of the usual suspects, but it does rather present his lackeys, flunkies and sundry lickspittles with a logistical issue, especially when the usual suspects are held to include tens of thousands of soldiers, academics, teachers and journalists, among many other unreliables. Where does one put them all? Turkey appears to have solved the problem by releasing 38,000 people who were already in prison, so there's room for the new arrivals. Daniela, Turkey predictably is denying this, but does it sound entirely coincidental to you?
It sounds extremely plausible, and it answers a question that I had in my own mind immediately after the coup, which is the attempted coup, which is obviously Erdogan has a list of people drawn up who he'd rather not see around. But really, where are they going to put all of these people? Because we're talking an enormous, enormous, enormous scale. I mean, already hundreds and hundreds have been sacked from their positions. But actually, if you're going to detain people...
The current score in total is about 23,000 arrested and 82,000 sacked or suspended.
Well, thousands and thousands indeed. So, yes, you need to have somewhere to put this. This has a rather nice symmetry, but... it's obviously extremely worrying, and it's just part of this massive crackdown which is ongoing. I mean, quite apart from the arrest, there's also inquiries into numerous businesses which apparently have links with the Gulen movement. This is all going to have a knock-on effect when it comes to the Turkish economy as well. And that's something I think that Erdogan has been trying to sort of, you know, not to dwell on. There has been a lot of international talk saying, well, you know, this is not a good time to invest in Turkey and things are going pretty badly.
James, do you get any sense that Erdogan has any clear ideas where he is going with this? Or is this one of those things that has just acquired some ghastly momentum all of its own?
I don't think anybody knows where this is heading. I mean, one of the terrible things, of course, is that for several decades, it seemed that, you know, Turkey was inching itself closer and closer to Europe. And there's been, you know, years of talk about finally joining the European Union at some point, although many people thought that was never going to happen. But now, all of a sudden, it seems to be lurching back towards almost, you know, the dark ages, effectively, with regard to coup d'etat attempts, the rounding up, as you rightly phrase it, of the usual suspects. You know, one wonders whether he might not be better off releasing these people so they can go and build some more prisons in which to put even more people, quite frankly. But it really is a desperate stage.
I mean, again, I guess a similar question to you, Daniela. That Erdogan will... one hopes at least apprehend the enormous damage this could be doing to Turkey in terms of its economy, in terms of its reputation, just in terms of its tourist trade. Do you think that he has any end game insight to this?
Do you know, I mean, I think he does. I don't think he's just quite feeling his way through all of this. I mean, this didn't come out of nowhere. He's been growing steadily more authoritarian for years and years. And the kind of hope that Turkey would be this remarkable symbiosis of Islam and democracy and East and West, I think, has faded, to almost a complete extent. Also, he's got a new friend, Russia.
It's heartwarming, isn't it?
Right. He's got the Russian. Like, you're worried about tourism? Yes, well, the Russian tourists are going to... He expects the Russian tourists to be coming back in droves after they have the detente. Similarly, the Russian markets, you know, this idea that Europe has turned its back on. You know, Europe is still like lingering because of they need Turkey because of the refugee crisis. But hey, new best friends is Russia with all its markets, with all its tourist potential, with all its political support. So and I don't think he's worried too much now about how he's going to appear before these limp-wristed, soft liberal...
panty waists, I think, is the phrase you're
looking
for.
It wasn't, but it's a good phrase.
Milka toasts has always been a particular
and
favourite.
And I understand that Russia has certain territories into which prisoners have historically been shipped.
Indeed, they do have form on that. On which subject, though, James, a leaked document in Germany this week has confirmed that German officials, or at least some German officials, do believe that Turkey is actively arming Islamist groups in Syria. Mm. This allegation has provoked predictable outrage from Ankara. They described it as, and I quote, a new indication of a twisted mentality. So there. when does it get to the point at which the West, by which you think of Europe and America, starts to think that for all that Turkey remains a member of NATO, it's not really meaningfully still on our side?
It's been going that way for a long time. If you remember back to the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003, one of the great problems that the Americans faced was that their ground strategy was to enter through the north via Turkey. And of course, they got refused the right to do so then in the aftermath of 9/11 and the ensuing incursion into Iraq. So this idea that Turkey has been a rather poor member of NATO is certainly nothing particularly new. The idea that it could be shifting away from being a rather neutral member to being something which is far more antagonistic, however, and as Dan Earlywright points out, cozying up to Vladimir Putin, it takes this to a whole new level.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we shall consider the case of Tae Yong-ho, until recently Deputy Ambassador of North Korea, based at the Democratic People's Republic's embassy in West London. He has defected, apparently wearied of life as a citizen of a miserable, oppressive, dysfunctional dystopia, although parts of Ealing aren't that bad. He does not wish to return to North Korea either. He surfaced after several weeks AWOL in Seoul. Daniela, how big a deal is this?
Well, apparently he's the most senior official to have ever defected, and it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of an embarrassment for North Korea. But I think North Korea is very much very far past worrying about such embarrassments.
This is how it's being reported. A huge embarrassment for North Korea. Is it though, really? Because one, presumably, almost nobody, or at least no ordinary citizen of North Korea, will ever know it happened. And I did look at Rodong Sinmun before we went to air, who don't appear to be covering this one, at least not yet. And really, in terms of North Korea's reputation abroad, I mean, it's not...
Could it get any worse?
Well, exactly.
We talk about it in a Western philosophy. It's, it's an embarrassment to the leadership there. But they'll deny it's ever happened. They won't announce it. They'll damn this individual, no doubt. Quite frankly, as you rightly allude to, how much lower the reputation of the North Korean leadership could possibly get is debatable.
It's kind of a glamorous idea, though, the defection, isn't it? It's old school. It was a big deal in the Cold War when somebody defected.
It was the only thing that made the Olympics worth watching, I remember, back as a child.
It still is, isn't it?
Well, that question of the Eastern European teams used to go home with rather fewer athletes than they arrived with, depending on where the Olympics was being held.
Exactly. And the Cubans aren't even doing it anymore, which is...
It has been a while since a proper defection, hasn't it?
It is, but if there's one lesson I think that can be gleaned from history of defections, it's this: never go back. Case in point, Saddam Hussein's son-in-laws defected to Jordan and were leading their lives quite merrily, and they got suggested, well, come back, all will be forgiven. And it was, of course, after Saddam had killed them. So if this chap is listening in South Korea, stay where you are.
They were kind of touchingly credulous types, Saddam's sons-in-law, clearly. Daniela, do you have any particular favourite defectors from history? Not athletes, obviously, but...
Well, I mean, all my favourites really are athletes. The sort of fun times from the Soviet era. It was a little bit more glamorous, and it was a bit more exciting. And it could be called a propaganda coup for the West. I'm intrigued about Bo Bergdahl, who I think could be been categorised as a defector
more recently in Afghanistan.
Yeah, exactly. But then the whole case is shrouded in so much secrecy that, you know, if he was an ideological defector, then that's of interest. But if he was just kind of batshit crazy, less intriguing.
I don't know. I'm always interested by the ones that defect in the unfashionable direction. And there are, in fact, there were six US soldiers who defected to North Korea during the Korean War, one of whom, Joe Dresnok, is still living in Pyongyang and occasionally does pop up on the news saying he has absolutely no regrets. But, you know, I do kind of wonder.
Well, it's interesting because the CIA did actually run a series of fake defectors to the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. And of course, one of the great conspiracy theorists, we were talking about this before we came on air, refers to Lee Harvey Oswald, who of course went to the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, tried to get citizenship of the Soviet Union, basically got turned down, and then returned to the United States with his Russian wife and managed to get a job on the motorcade above President Kennedy.
Something for which Donald Trump will doubtless blame Hillary Clinton should those debates ever transpire. James Boyes and Daniela Pellad, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next at 1900, The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. I'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.